Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the APS Portfolio Strategy Call, the market impact of mortgage forbearance. Even before Congress passed the CARES Act in late March, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Ginnie Mae had started outlining some kind of debt relief for their borrowers. And forbearance in the mortgage market has quickly become a second track of market impact, second only to the activities of the Fed. The CARES Act sped up the process and made it easy for borrowers to get relief with minimal proof of hardship. That has raised the possibility of a large number of borrowers suspending payments potentially for up to 12 months. A wave of forbearance could have an obvious big impact on MBS prepayments, potentially suppressing speeds for now, although possibly raising them later. And it also could affect servicers, forcing them to advance substantial amounts of cash to securities holders. With all of that, we wanted to spend some time this afternoon digging into the details. I am joined today by Brian Landy, a senior strategist here at Amherst Pierpont, focusing on agency MBS. And later in the session, we'll be joined by Chris Helwig, a senior strategist focusing on mortgage credit, and by Mary Beth Fisher, a senior strategist focusing on CMBS. At the end of our discussion, which we're targeting for about 25 minutes, we'll open the call to questions from the listening audience. I'll also remind you that on the webinar, you can follow a few slides that we'll use at a few points, and you can also see a chat feature along the right side of the screen. The chat feature lets you ask questions throughout the discussion, so please ask questions as they come up, and we'll turn to them during the open Q&A part of the call. But for now, let's get right into it, and let's turn to Brian Landy first. And Brian, let's start by possibly finding out what we know at this point about the level of forbearance so far.
Hi. Yeah, the forbearance has spiked quite a bit. It's, according to the latest Mortgage Banker Survey, up to 5.95%, which is an increase from only 0.25% on March 2nd. Now, loans in Ginnie Mae pools have jumped even higher, according to the survey, and they're up to 8.26%. Now, mortgage bankers that we've spoken to have said that a lot of this has come in a surge at the end of March and beginning of April, roughly when payments for March were due. Some bankers said we might see another surge in mid-April when borrowers face a deadline for making payments without a late fee. But from what we've heard, that didn't really end up happening, or the pickup was fairly modest.
So, Brian, do the bankers have some expectations for the level of forbearance we're going to see in the next couple of months?
Oh, well, they have some guesses, but there is a lot of uncertainty around it. A number of bankers we spoke to said they thought forbearance in Ginnie Mae program would peak at around 20% over the next few months, and with forbearance in the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac programs peaking at around 10%. But nobody seemed to have tremendous confidence in those numbers. This is the first time that we've seen forbearance programs that are so easy to get into with no initial impact on the borrower's credit score. And there's no impact because the delinquency doesn't get reported in that way to the consumer credit bureaus. So no one has a precedent for figuring out the impact this time around.
Okay, let's dig into the detail then on how these forbearance programs work. Exactly how easy is it to actually get some kind of suspension of your mortgage payments?
Well, the requirements are simple. The borrower needs to attest that they've suffered a hardship due to COVID-19. No proof of hardship is required. The servicers are able to offer forbearance through websites, through call centers, or even email. Possibly servicers that were quicker to build websites have been able to process forbearance requests faster than those that relied solely on call centers. Now, this attestation does seem to deter some borrowers, you know, that worry that maybe there could be some repercussion later on if they were to misrepresent their situation. And some borrowers might decide against forbearance, you know, just if they worry that it might limit opportunities to refinance in the future. And now, just to clarify on that point, forbearance might make it harder to refinance if the borrower mishandled the situation. But if a borrower had the ability to become current again, and there's probably nothing about the forbearance that would really stop a future refinancing.
Okay, what about any penalties or costs for getting into the program?
Not really. There's nothing really. The agencies record the loan as delinquent, but they do not report that delinquency to the Consumer Credit Bureau, so the borrower's credit score is unaffected.
And so once the borrower's in the program, then, you know, what happens? What happens is that forbearance continues.
Well, the borrower can initially request up to 6 months of forbearance. Now, that suspends the principal, interest, tax, and insurance payments. Now, at the end of 6 months, the borrower can request another 6 months. And so, in total, that allows a maximum of 12 months of forbearance. Now, for the average loan, that would equal, you know, about 7.5% of the principal balance of the loan. However, we're not seeing that so far. Most of the early requests, you know, according to the bankers we've spoken to, are for a few months, but now it's very early on in the process. This might be because bankers are making the shorter terms more prominent on their websites or when they call. You know, another possibility is that because borrowers might really be worried about catching up on payments later on and trying to avoid going too deep into delinquency. So we'll have to see how it progresses.
And is this just an open-ended opportunity, or is there some kind of window on actually making that request?
Yeah, there is an end date to it. The initial request and any extension request has to be made no later than 120 days after the president declares the COVID emergency over.
Okay, and that has not happened yet, obviously. So the borrower goes into forbearance. Presumably they have the ability to ask for extensions. What happens when forbearance ends?
Okay. Well, first, for borrowers that have cash in the bank, you know, they could just pay back the accumulated principal, interest, taxes, and insurance and return to their regularly scheduled mortgage payments and end it that way. Now, for borrowers that don't have the available cash, the agencies and the borrower, you know, will have to come up with some sort of repayment plan. Now, the details vary depending on whether the loan is a conventional or government loan, but generally the borrower will need to repay the forbearance over some time frame. Now, remember, they will also have to start making their regularly scheduled mortgage payment at the same time. So this probably works for borrowers that only use a few months of forbearance. But for borrowers that go to the maximum of 12 months, repaying that amount and making their regular payment, it could certainly take a very long time. And we don't really know if the agencies plan to accommodate payment plans of that length. Now, for borrowers that don't fit into a repayment plan, the FHA does have a unique solution. So the accumulated money owed is basically added to the last scheduled payment on the existing loan, and it sits there without interest. Now, the borrower would end up repaying that amount if they were to move, but if a borrower refinances into another FHA loan, the money owed gets stuck onto the end of that new loan. Now, if they try to refinance into a conventional loan, then they have to repay that forbearance. Otherwise, the FHA would try to recover the forbearance if the borrower were to default. Now, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they also have a new program for borrowers that don't fit into a repayment plan. It's pretty limited. So the GSEs will either have to accommodate long repayment plans or will have to come up with other solutions. And as for the VA, you know, there's really kind of nothing, you know, besides either the borrower curing or doing a repayment plan. There's really nothing else, you know, for a borrower that doesn't fit into those. So finally, after all those efforts to repay the forbearance, all the agencies and FHA and VA would turn to the usual delinquency and loss mitigation rules. If the borrower were to go delinquent then, all the possibilities are on the table, including loan modification, you know, and really and beyond to liquidation.
Okay, so that seems at least somewhat straightforward. You roll from forbearance potentially into repayment. You've got the FHA solution, and then beyond repayment, you're back to the usual delinquency and loss mitigation protocol. So, okay, so that's the borrower's view of the experience. Oh, actually, during that forbearance, can the borrower prepay?
Yeah, you know, they might be able to, but probably won't. Now, I mean, remember, during the forbearance, you know, the borrower has a zero monthly payment, and really nothing beats that. Now, even if a refinance ignores the fact that the loan was delinquent, the borrowers would have to pay back the forbearance amount immediately. Probably most borrowers won't be able to or want to do that and also pay the cost to refinance. You know, plus, the lender will verify income and employment during the refinance process, you know, which presumably most borrowers on forbearance would be unable to do.
Okay, let's look at it then from the servicer's perspective for a moment. Once a loan goes into forbearance, obviously the borrower is not paying PI and TI on the loan. Who actually is doing that?
Okay, well, we've prepared a slide on this. Now, remember, investors will always get timely principal and interest payments regardless of what the servicer is doing. So this issue is really about whether the servicers can handle the demand of advancing cash flows. So the servicer is always required to make tax and insurance payments once the borrower's escrow account is depleted. Now, principal and interest advancing is a little complex because it differs across the agencies. You know, for Fannie Mae, it depends on whether the servicer has sold the loan at the cash window or into an MBS pool. In general, servicers don't need to advance principal and interest on loans sold at the cash window, but they do advance principal interest for loans sold into pools. Now, on Tuesday, the FHFA and Fannie Mae announced that principal and interest would only be advanced for 4 months, which aligns with Freddie Mac's duration. Now, as for Freddie Mac, the servicer advances interest for 4 months, but does not advance any principal. And finally, for all loans in Ginnie Mae pools, you know, so which includes FHA and VA, the servicer has to advance principal and interest for as long as the loan remains in the pool.
All right. What about the ability to end the advancing by buying a loan out of the pool?
Okay. Well, we've prepared another slide on this. Now, remember, the buyout is avoided in many circumstances. So we already know that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac servicers only have to advance for 4 months. And for the government programs, if the borrower becomes current or goes into a repayment plan or gets payments deferred, like the FHA's program, then the loan would stay in the, you know, would stay in the pool and avoid a buyout. Now, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac do have the option to buy out delinquent loans, which they generally do when a loan reaches 120 days delinquent. However, they have stated that loans on COVID-19 forbearance plans and loans on repayment plans will remain in pools regardless of the delinquency status. Otherwise, loans that are not on a repayment plan must be bought out after they become 24 months delinquent or if there's a loan modification or liquidation. Now, Ginnie Mae, they give the buyout option to the servicer, so which can be exercised on any loan that is at least 90 days delinquent. Bank servicers have generally bought out loans very soon after they reach that threshold, while non-bank servicers typically let delinquent loans remain in pools. Then the buyout becomes mandatory for loans that are modified or liquidated.
Okay, so the servicers are posting all of this cash, at least especially in the FHA and VA programs. Who reimburses them?
Okay, and yeah, we have a third slide that covers this. For the GSEs, the GSEs reimburse the servicer for principal, interest, taxes, and insurance advances, but the timing is different. So at Fannie Mae, they do it faster. Advanced principal and interest gets reimbursed when a loan becomes current or as part of a repayment plan or when the loan is bought out of a pool. Tax and insurance expenses can be claimed as soon as they have been paid. Freddie Mac servicers wait longer. The interest, tax, and insurance advances are recovered when a loan becomes current or as part of a repayment plan. Otherwise, they are generally reimbursed when a loan is modified or liquidated. Now, Ginnie Mae, they never reimburse for principal and interest advances because the servicers, in the end, get principal and interest reimbursement from the FHA and VA. So, in principal, interest, taxes, and insurance are reimbursed by those entities when the borrower becomes current or is part of a repayment plan or if the loan is modified or liquidated.
Okay, so if we get a little bit beyond the mechanics of forbearance and then the mechanics of what the servicer is doing, there's the investment impact. And where does the forbearance hit the hardest, in Ginnie Mae or conventional?
Well, Ginnie Mae should be hit much harder than conventional, which is primarily due to the weaker credit quality of the FHA borrower. You know, as I mentioned earlier, servicers seem to be thinking 20% forbearance in Ginnie Mae, 10% in conventional, which is kind of in line with our initial thinking. Now, there was a wide range of views, but everybody thinks Ginnie forbearance rates will be much higher than conventional, and we're seeing that in the MBA forbearance data and the data that we've, you know, heard from servicers as well. Now, within Ginnie Mae, VA loans should have a much lower forbearance rate than FHA, and perhaps fairly close to conventional. So the FHA forbearance might reach, say, 25% or higher. Now, after the forbearance is over, it is also likely that Ginnie Mae loans will end up being slower. Now, remember, a share of those loans will get their forbearance pushed to the end of the loan schedule. So the borrower will have a small, you know, effectively a small 0% loan that they don't have to repay for years. They can do that FHA to FHA refinance, but not FHA to conventional without paying that 0% loan off. Now, conventional borrowers could end up in repayment plans, but that would create high monthly payments. I mean, that might actually add to the incentive that a conventional borrower has to refinance if they could get a lower payment by spreading that, spreading that arrearage effectively across the entire new loan term.
Okay, so is that uniform across all Ginnie coupons, or are there differences across the coupons?
Oh, there are differences. FHA loans in particular make up a much larger percentage of higher coupons and lower coupons. And so, for example, in Ginnie 30-year 4%, FHA loans make up almost 70% of the balance. But in 30-year 3%, FHA loans are only 45%. So higher coupons should see more forbearance and therefore a more pronounced drop in prepayment speeds.
What about the conventional programs? What are the views on relative speeds and potential relative value there?
Sure. I mean, you know, definitely one thing is that expect loans with high LTVs and or low FICOs should see the biggest impact. You know, these borrowers, they either stretch to buy a home or demonstrated worse credit behavior in the past, you know, more likely to need access to the forbearance program because of that. You know, the buyout data that you can look at for conventionals back in 2010 kind of illustrates what happened in the past. Low FICO and high LTV loans accumulated far more delinquencies over the course of 2008 and 2009 than did high FICO loans or low LTV borrowers. And, you know, also mentioned, like, high LTV borrowers, they have less skin in the game. So, you know, they might be more inclined to use forbearance and later less likely to cure if there happens to be a drop in home prices.
Okay, super, Brian. Appreciate it. For listeners that have questions, we can follow up in the Q&A session on the details of forbearance, the servicing, or some of the relative value impacts. But let's turn now to the credit side of the agency equation, and then we'll touch on the private label side as well, focusing still now on residential. And for that, I want to turn to Chris Helwig. Chris, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have decided on a particular approach to these loans and forbearance when it comes to their credit risk transfers. They're counting those loans as delinquencies, and that's going to affect the CRT cash flows.
Yes, it will. Effectively, you can think of CRT as falling into three different categories. The earliest set of deals done between 2013 and 2015, if a loan's delinquent more than 180 days, it triggers what's called in their vernacular a credit event, and its severity is applied to those loans according to a fixed schedule, which increases with the amount of credit events. For those deals, this treatment of forbearance will likely generate loans on losses that may never actually default. Some of those deals either allow for a reversal of those credit events or a grace period before they are determined to be credit events if they're the result of a natural disaster. We've seen that work in hurricanes that hit Florida and Houston, as well as Puerto Rico a few years ago. The GSEs recently decided to count the coronavirus as a natural disaster for the purpose of prepayments, but have not provided official guidance as to whether the treatment will be the same in credit risk transfer deals, and that's kind of an important nuance that we're waiting to get clarification on. Finally, there's a majority of these deals that pay off according to realized losses on the loans. Those deals have triggers that shut off principal if delinquencies exceed certain levels. We'll probably see those triggers hit, so the average life of these deals will extend, potentially exposing them to greater losses. Additionally, loans where the borrower is granted payment forbearance and subsequently put on a payment plan to repay the missed payments will be considered delinquent until those missed payments are fully recouped, which could keep these delinquencies elevated for some time. You know, a lot of this may not be new news, and we've certainly seen price action that has reflected some of this new risk. In terms of where we see pockets of value, we certainly think, you know, seasoned actual loss transactions that have deleveraged significantly and have large stores of home price appreciation underneath them appear to offer the best relative value.
Okay, so let me just step away from the agency market for a second and ask about private label MBS. There's no agency obviously mandating a particular approach, so it seems like we could end up seeing a pretty wide range of solutions. When you talk to servicers of the non-agency market, what are you hearing about forbearance?
So, yeah, to your point, I mean, there's no clear-cut guidelines for private label servicers, but conversations with those servicers have helped to shed light on some of their policies may differ from GSE guidelines. First off, payment forbearance periods will likely be shorter than those offered by GSE borrowers, likely 3 to 6 months at a maximum rather than 6 to 12 for GSE borrowers. Additionally, it appears that payment forbearance will not be a one-time extension, but will rather be reevaluated on a monthly basis by the servicer. And borrowers will likely have some onus on them to demonstrate hardship as opposed to GSE policies where they do not. While policies may differ, it appears there is at least an eye towards at least a loose alignment of interest with GSE programs so that there's not, you know, a huge disparity between the two. Away from that, advancing policies on loans in payment forbearance may differ from servicer to servicer, but one likely outcome is that the servicer will advance on those loans in a given month, but will recoup those advances the next, effectively creating a netting effect to deal cash flows. Additionally, advancing policies will differ program to program. Some prime jumbo issuers have a 120-day stop advance policy, while some non-QM programs employ a 180-day stop advance. And some non-QM programs actually don't require the servicer to advance at all in the case of a borrower hardship.
Okay, so we'll have to wait to see what becomes common and best practice in that space. Okay, let's finally turn to agency CMBS, where there's also been forbearance policies rolled out, but so far a little bit of a different picture. Mary Beth Fisher follows that market for us. Mary Beth, we know Fannie, Freddie, Ginnie, they also securitize multifamily properties, mortgages on those properties, and there's obviously potential for renters in those buildings to end up unemployed with problem making the rent. What kind of forbearance are we seeing at this point out of the agencies for their multifamily borrowers?
Well, the multifamily programs look a little bit different than the residential programs. All three of the agencies are offering forbearance programs for these borrowers. The programs incorporate the eviction moratorium for tenants that was outlined in the CARES Act. Each agency offers multifamily borrowers up to 90 days of forbearance, an initial forbearance period of 30 days, which may be extended for two additional 30-day periods. The implementation of the forbearance program is a little bit different at each agency. There are kind of varying standards for documentation, payment amounts that can be forborne, and ongoing levels of surveillance. Whether or not multifamily borrowers utilize the forbearance programs they still have to comply with the CARES Act, meaning they're restricted from initiating eviction proceedings against tenants, charging fees or penalties for nonpayment of rent for 120 days from the date of enactment of the CARES Act. That was March 27th, 2020. That would take them to a 100-day period till the end of July. After that, they would need to issue a 30-day eviction notice.
Okay, so have we actually seen any evidence that forbearance is on the rise?
We have. It's just been really small so far. There's been a little bit of uptake. It's not been nearly the uptake you've seen on the single-family side. Overall, the percentage of multifamily borrowers with an approved forbearance request looks to be in the very low single digits, as in well below 5%. There are two reasons for this. The number of borrowers who can demonstrate a financial need based on nonpayment of rent by the tenants is still relatively low. And while the programs were initially described as if a borrower would be awarded forbearance practically on request, similar to the single family universe, in fact, the documentation and operational hurdles are more involved. Right now, the vast majority of tenants, 89% nationally, made full or partial rent payments in April. Servicers are asking multifamily borrowers requesting forbearance to submit their rent rolls. This is actually a wonderful thing, and it's one way to make sure that forbearance is actually reaching borrowers that have need for the financial assistance. They have a lot of borrowers so far who are asking about the program, but relatively few that have actively pursued it because a lot of them can't yet demonstrate they need the forbearance. Those that do need it, it tends to be concentrated in Class C properties, low-income housing, or those in harder-hit geographic areas. Importantly, Fannie Mae this afternoon just released their first properties that have entered forbearance, and it's a list of four properties, $94 million in total, which will put them, for Fannie Mae DUS pools, probably at below 1% of all outstanding DUS. That list available if anybody wants to see it. HUD's forbearance program is actually experiencing probably the largest number of requests, and it is obviously skewed toward the lower income housing sector. One important caveat, tenants who are in Section 8 housing or on government support typically have sticky housing vouchers, and those rents will continue to be paid because they tend to go straight to the landlord, not to the tenants.
Okay, fantastic. Mary Beth, thank you for that. Brian and Chris, thanks for that great recap. At this point, I just want to turn and open the field to questions. As I mentioned, if you look on the right side of your webinar screen, you can see a chat box where you can submit questions. And I'm looking at the list that has already started rolling in, and we've got a very healthy one so far. Please don't hesitate to ask any further questions. We'll try to get to as many as we can, at least as long as time allows. But let me start with one that came in early in the session. And Brian Landy, I guess I would address this one to you. I know you've had some conversation with servicers on this topic. So a client is asking, do borrowers understand what forbearance means? And if they don't understand that, can we assume that we would get more default in the future when the forbearance period ends?
Yeah, I mean, servicers are certainly supposed to describe to the borrower exactly what it means. It's like, for example, Fannie Mae, they recently posted kind of model language for how a servicer is supposed to kind of handle that contact with the borrower. And a lot of it, I think, is really centered around trying to communicate the requirement that, you know, the money isn't being forgiven, that at the end of the forbearance term, you are expected to be able to pay that back. I think it's maybe an open question how successful those efforts would be, or, you know, I guess I could, you know, argue that, you know, if you're clicking through a website, maybe somebody's not as likely to understand that. But I think it's probably one of the reasons that servicers, I think, are tending to only allow shorter term forbearance through like a more automated process. And then if you really want to ask for 6 months, they're not going to say no. But I think a lot of that gets directed to a phone call so that you can have a better conversation about the you know, overall impact of going on forbearance and what it means.
Okay, let me swing to a question coming in from a client. This is regarding the reporting of delinquencies. Brian, as you mentioned, the GSEs and Ginnie Mae, they do not report delinquencies to the credit bureaus, so the borrower's credit score is unaffected. The question is, who do they report to? Is it fair to assume that they really are just keeping this as part of their own records, and so there's no reporting beyond the GSE's own information gathering?
Yeah, I mean, that's my understanding, is that the servicer needs to keep track. The GSEs will keep track. And so something like that, you know, would get, delinquency would get reported through to an MBS pool, for example. But yeah, it doesn't go beyond that. So it's not, not a borrower level report from the servicer to the credit agencies, or, you know, that's specifically what CARES says, is not that they cannot send that, cannot report the delinquency to their credit bureaus. Now, if a loan is already delinquent heading into the forbearance, then they are allowed to continue reporting that constant delinquency. So like if a borrower were 60 days delinquent already, then goes on CARES forbearance, they can report 60, you know, constant throughout. But if a borrower is current, they have to report current to the bureaus.
Okay, and then a question on the refinancing implications of forbearance. Can you just kind of recap again the ability or lack thereof to refinance during forbearance?
Sure. Well, I mean, if you're in order to do that refinance, you would need to cure the forbearance really as part of the refi process, or before you do the refi. I mean, so I think there's certainly a few things that, in my mind, I think stand in the way. I mean, one is that as a part of that refi, I mean, if you really need forbearance because you've had some sort of hardship that's affected your employment or income, when they try to underwrite you for the new loan, that's going to come up, right? So you might not be able to refi just purely for that reason alone. So during the forbearance period, if somehow you're able to come up with the cash, I guess, it's certainly conceivable that you could decide to pay the forbearance off, become current, work through a refi, and do that instead. But, you know, my guess is a lot of borrowers, if they really need the forbearance, are probably less likely to have the cash to do that to begin with. And then also to, on top of that, be ready to pay the closing costs or for the new loan.
Okay, so again, a question coming in now, going a little bit further out in the timeline to after the forbearance period, potentially after the 12-month period. What's our thinking at this point on buyout risk across the different agencies, and do we have, any preliminary estimates for the percentage of loans that we think might end up as buyout?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's right now it's really hard without a good view of how many loans will use shorter term forbearance versus longer forbearance. I think if a borrower really only uses 2 months and gets their job back and decides to try to cure from there, I think the options are a lot greater. Part of it will depend, I think, on whether if you really imagine a borrower using 12 months of forbearance, what kind of repayment plan they might be able to access. The sort of standard repayment plans are, I think, relatively short. I think like servicers are typically allowed to offer, without contacting the GSEs, for example, up to 12 months of forbearance, and the payment isn't supposed to go up, be more than 50% more than the existing loan payment. So that, I don't see that a 12-month forbearance would fit into that, would really fit into those parameters. So I think you're really, in order to even come close to that, really, you're going to come up with a much longer payment period. So if the GSEs do that, then that would certainly lower the buyout risk. FHA's program, I think, has a tremendous ability to take borrowers and effectively cure them of their delinquency post-forbearance, which would allow those loans to stay in the pool. And so you kind of see that if you look at, I always like to look at the the effect of Hurricane Maria after in Puerto Rico, just because it's sort of a very clean case to look at, where you really know the hurricane hit the island and, you know, the effect was widespread. And if you look at Ginnie Mae speeds on some of the, you know, vintages that were produced and kind of went through that crisis, that the buyout rates, you know, really didn't pick up that much. You know, a couple extra CPR, throughout kind of the mid part and latter part of 2018. Where if you look at GSE speeds at times, you know, there were months they hit, you know, 40, 50, 60 CPR, which obviously is extremely fast for Puerto Rico pool. So I think that, and that was only 6 months forbearance, right? So I think that kind of speaks to the difference where a long-term forbearance on the GSE side, if there's not some better, option for a long-term repayment plan, probably does drive up buyout risk. Where on the FHA side, I think a lot of these loans might escape without the buyout.
Yeah, that's kind of an important point. And based on a couple of questions in the queue, I just would want to clarify. There's some questions about exactly what the FHA solution is. And Brian, correct me if I'm missing something here, but effectively, if an FHA borrower goes into forbearance for 12 months, on average, they're going to be building up an amount owed equivalent to roughly 7.5% of their loan balance. That amount gets really moved to the very last payment period of their regularly scheduled mortgage, and it sits there effectively as a 0% interest-free loan until they either move or refinance into some kind of conventional loan. So with that forbearance sitting there still in the payment schedule, a percentage of their loan effectively sits out there interest-free, which is one of the reasons that there's been thinking that after forbearance is over, there's ongoing incentive for the borrower to stay in the loan because a portion of it is now interest-free. So let me turn a little bit here and focus on an issue, Chris, in the disconnect between the treatment of these loans for the purposes of prepayment and the treatment of the loans for CRT. I know there's been a lot of conversation there. What's qualitatively happening there, and do we see any progress on that front?
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it's a nuanced but important point. And I think when everybody saw the SFA release on Tuesday and kind of latched onto that language that COVID-19 will be treated as a natural disaster for the purposes of the guaranteed MBS, the natural follow-on was to say, okay, then we have these set of fixed severity deals, not inclusive of the first four stacker deals, which don't have natural disaster language, and that's another important point. There are a set of fixed severity deals where if these loans are effectively deemed to be in a natural disaster area, then, you know, you have this 18-month moratorium before we review these to be credit events. If at that point they're still 180 days down, they're considered a credit event and the fixed severity is applied. You know, I can't say with any real insight as to why there's incongruity or a lack of communication to both sets of investors at this point. But, you know, I would think given the fact that they chose to use that exact language, that for those deals that have the natural disaster language, it should get a favor. In my estimation, there should likely be some alignment there. But there's been nothing officially communicated from the enterprises or FHFA to that end.
Okay, Chris, let me follow up again. A client is asking a related question. So under the assumption that the GSEs continue to report the borrowers in forbearance as delinquent, until they've completed their payment plan. I guess the question is, could the CRT DQ triggers continue to fail?
Yes. The simple answer is yes. And there's an interesting nuanced point there in that if a borrower who comes out of forbearance is put on a payment plan, which by definition, at least right now, has to be no longer than a year to make up the missed payments, they will be considered delinquent as long until all those payments are recouped by the agencies. Now, conversely, if those missed payments are put in deferral and stapled to the maturity of the loan, that borrower will be considered current once he makes his next payment. So oddly, the borrowers who are making those payments up sooner are effectively going to wind up being delinquent longer.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Question now on pooling of loans that are going into forbearance, and I know that we've heard news on that just within the last couple of days. And basically the question is, can a new loan that immediately enters forbearance be pooled? And is the policy the same for all three agencies? Brian, I think you've been all over that one. What do we know there?
Yeah, so the GSE has just announced yesterday that they would allow loans that were in forbearance, so basically the loan closed, the borrower then asked for forbearance, but the loan sale had not yet been completed to the GSEs, that that loan would be that they would be willing to purchase that loan. However, they are putting on a huge LOPA in order to buy that loan. So it's either 500 or 700 basis points up front to allow the loan to be delivered to the GSEs. So it's they are taking it. I think they realize there's probably, you know, there is a timing issue with that's affecting originators, and you know, they did come up with a solution, but certainly the fee is very high.
Okay, got it. All right, we've got quite a long list of questions, so I do apologize. I don't know if we're going to be able to get to all of them. I'm trying to pick the ones where it seems to be the most overlap. So let's go back, because here's another question about what happens at the end of this process. Effectively, the waterfall for a conventional loan after forbearance expires, and the borrower cannot make a lump sum payment to catch up. Brian, I know you and I have discussed this. Effectively, if I'm remembering correctly, the options become either repayment or some kind of payment deferral, or absent payment deferral, it's down the usual course of delinquency and loss mitigation. Am I recalling correctly?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are the fundamental options. You know, the payment deferral steps in, first, obviously, if the borrower can cure the delinquency by just paying it back, that's most desirable. But I mean, absent that, you would be evaluated for the payment deferral program, which works a lot like the FHA's program, but it would only cover 1 to 2 months of delinquency. So really, and actually the rules for even getting into it are a little bit more narrow than that. So it's, probably targets a very limited selection of borrowers and really just those who only need 1 to 2 months and then are able to start making their payments again. And then beyond that, you would look at a repayment plan. I mentioned and Chris mentioned, I mean, the standard term would be up to 12 months, and there's a limit on what the total payment can be relative to the existing mortgage payment. And I think for anybody in a really long forbearance period, that it's probably quite unlikely to fit into those parameters. So I think it depends on how much, you know, flexibility the GSEs are willing to extend beyond that. And then, you know, failing those options, then it really turns to other loss mitigation options like a loan modification.
Okay, let me just also, I know in our discussions, Brian, we talked about what the GSEs have said about their repayment plans, and at this point, there's very limited information. It's clear that loans can get forbearance from Fannie or Freddie for up to 12 months. It's clear that they have some aspirations that at the end of that period, some borrowers may be able to come to the table with cash. They have some very limited payment deferral plans, nothing on the order of FHA. And so it seems like the two main options are repayment or, as you were describing, going down their normal DQ and loss mitigation paths. On the repayment, Brian, you were mentioning to me the other day that there's a limit that GSEs have set that the monthly payment can only be 150% of their regularly scheduled mortgage payment. So that also becomes a binding parameter. And presumably, if a lot of these borrowers already have a debt-to-income ratio that's in the 30s or 40s, that has to be a limiting event as well. So it'll be very interesting to see what the GSEs do. If they do end up putting a lot of borrowers into long repayment plans, then those borrowers are going to have higher than normal monthly payments, and that could be a significant incentive to refinance. And if they don't put a lot of these borrowers into repayment plans, then presumably there's significant risk of buyouts, which would also generate prepayments. And those outcomes are in pretty clear contrast to the likely outcome in the FHA program, where borrowers essentially can take most of the money owed and staple it into a 0% loan not due for several years, which is partly why we think Ginnie's speeds are likely to be low during the forbearance period and then remain lower than conventional speeds afterwards. Okay, let me see if I can touch on any other topics that we have not touched on so far. I don't know if we've heard any of this. This could be either for Brian or Chris. But have we heard of any borrowers asking for forbearance and then asking to be pulled out of forbearance, or is it just too early in the process?
In my conversations with servicers, I don't think there's been much of that experience to date. If anything, I think the problem is more of the opposite, and I know Brian addressed some of the different ways to potentially get, a forbearance for borrowers to get forbearance extended to them. But I still believe in conversations with certain servicers that there are significant backlogs of borrowers that are still trying to get in touch with their servicer. So I think the possibility that a borrower could effectively, for lack of a better term, round trip their forbearance and get a servicer to reply to them twice is probably fairly remote at this juncture.
Okay. All right. Let's see. I guess here's a question. Are servicers going to be reporting the COVID-19 DQs differently than DQs triggered by other factors? Do we have any information on that?
There's kind of standardized coding for how the delinquencies are reported. You know, they're effectively numerical, right? So unless they change their existing kind of taxonomy for how they treated loans, I don't think there's going to be any special disclosures unless you had a differing view.
No, I mean, I think as far as what's reported through to the investor on a pool, I mean, you won't be able to tell necessarily a COVID delinquency from another. Now, you know that, you know, typically, like, say, if you look at Freddie's disclosures, very few loans are ever reported in the 120-plus delinquent bucket, right? Now we should see a lot of loans and, you know, fill into that bucket. And so you'd probably, you know, given the timing, be able to make a good guess why they're there. You know, and there, I don't know if there's, you know, back-end coding differences, you know, in terms of how the servicer reports to the GSC, but I don't think there's any plans to, you know, pass that sort of information onto the security.
Okay, and then one last question, again, focusing on servicing. It looks like with the conventional announcement that they've relieved a lot of the concern there, since servicers really only have to advance for 4 months. But we still know that the Ginnie servicers are going to have to advance potentially for a longer amount of time. Brian, can you just briefly recap how the servicer then gets reimbursed?
So you mean reimbursed, like, after they've made the advances?
In the FHA or VA case.
Right. So, I mean, first, if a borrower either, you know, cures a delinquency by just, you know, being able to make the payments to come back to current, or if they can get onto a repayment plan, then the servicer can, you know, recoup the advances from, you know, either of those events. So effectively they're paid back, you know, by the borrower when they become current. So for the FHA, that's a lot of what this payment deferral program really does, is that the borrower's missed payments, the servicer is able to get those payments stuck onto the end of the loan. But in turn, they go to the FHA and get a payment from the FHA for the delinquent principal, interest, and tax and insurance payments. And so that goes to pay, the loan gets marked current, and then that cash would go to pay back the servicer for their advances.
Okay, super. Thank you very much. For all those on the phone, I think at this point, in the interest of time and in the noticing that the questions are also petering off, I think we'll wrap up. We will save one question for the panelists to consider and answer later, and that is, what is your favorite character from the movie Saving Private Ryan? Listeners can feel free to contact the analysts for that answer. In any event, we should have a replay of this call and slides available tomorrow. This wraps up today's APS Portfolio Strategy Call, The Market Impact of Mortgage Forbearance. Thank you for your time. Be safe, be well, and good luck in the markets.